So, good afternoon. This is Read Me Something You Love. And today I am sitting in a lovely book-bedecked office, one of those academic offices in UCL with Alex Preston.
Hi. It's not my office.
It's not.
It's borrowed.
Are you saying it's not your office because you don't want me to sort of make assumptions about you from the books and particularly the prints on the, we've got these sort of Tuscany summer, Linda Cook. You don't want me to make assumptions about you from the books and the prints?
I can only say that the person who is usually in this office who kindly lends it to me to take tutorials is a wonderful lady. So, and there are some very good books on the shelves.
Yes, absolutely. I'm seeing everything from Chaucer to Shalom Auslander over there, which is that's quite a span.
Which I only kind of worked out the other day is obviously Howdy Stranger in Yiddish.
It doesn't really have the same.
It doesn't have the same. No, exactly.
So Alex is a name you hopefully will recognise. He's had his second novel out very, very recently, The Revelations. And your first novel was This Bleeding City.
That's right.
Which I very much enjoyed. I haven't read Revelations yet.
I'll get you a copy.
And I also enjoyed your long-titled, which is why I've got a little thing here to remind me what it is, very long-titled short story, which was long-listed for the equally long-titled Sunday Times Private Bank EFG Short Story Award.
I think EFG Private Bank, unless Sunday Times have set up a private bank.
You see, I've said it about 100 times and I still couldn't say it right. And your story was The Bridge Over Shuto Expressway,
number one. Yes, that's right.
Which is a really great story. That's only available. Is that available at all anywhere?
It is not. It is currently languishing somewhere in Granta's offices, to which I sent it many months before. I probably must submit it somewhere else.
Okay, well, Granta, if you're listening to this, get something out.
It is somewhere in your offices.
Put it off whatever pile it's on.
Exactly.
It won't be on the slush pile. You won't be on the slush pile, but you'll be on another pile, I'm sure. You know, the to-be-considered pile. So let's get straight to the reading then. So you've chosen... Well, why don't you introduce it for us?
As I said, this is atypical of Wallace. It's a story called Incarnations of Burned Children. And I think it probably deserves a health warning, which is that this is a profoundly difficult, painful story to read. I was speaking to one of my tutors here at UCL, Michael Seyu, who's just amazing on Wallace, writes brilliantly on him. And he said, you can't read that. You cannot read that story because it is so incredibly painful. And yet, I think it is totally wonderful. It's only just over 1,000 words long. It's a very short story, but he just does so much in it, and he takes you on an astonishing journey over the three pages of this story. So I will begin. Incarnations of Burned Children by David Foster Wallace. The daddy was around the side of the house hanging a door for the tenant when he heard the child's screams and the mummy's voice gone high between them. He could move fast, and the back porch gave onto the kitchen, and before the screen door had banged shut behind him, the daddy had taken the scene in whole. The overturned pot on the floor tile before the stove, and the burner's blue jet, and the floor's pool of water still steaming as its many arms extended, the toddler in his baggy diaper standing rigid with steam coming off his hair and his chest and shoulders scarlet, and his eyes rolled up and mouth open very wide and seeming somehow separate from the sounds that issued, the mummy down on one knee with the dish rag dabbing pointlessly at him, and matching the screams with cries of her own. Hysterical, so she was almost frozen. Her one knee and the bare little soft feet were still in the steaming pool. And the daddy's first act was to take the child under the arms and lift him away from it and take him to the sink, where he threw out plates and struck the tap to let cold well water run over the boy's feet, while with his cupped hand he gathered and poured or flung more cold water over the head and shoulders and chest, wanting first to see the steam stop coming off him. The mummy over his shoulder invoking God until he sent her for towels and gauze if they had it. The daddy moving quickly and well, his man's mind empty of everything but purpose, not yet aware of how smoothly he moved, or that he'd ceased to hear the high screams, because to hear them would freeze him and make impossible what had to be done to help his own child, whose screams were regular as breath, and went on so long they'd become already a thing in the kitchen, something else to move quickly around. The tenant's side door outside hung half off its top hinge and moved slightly in the wind, and a bird in the oak across the driveway appeared to observe the door with a cocked head as the cries still came from inside. The worst scald seemed to be on the right arm and shoulder. The chest and stomach's red was fading to pink under the cold water, and his feet's soft soles weren't blistered that the daddy could see. But the toddler still made little fists and screamed, except maybe now merely on reflex from fear. The daddy would know he thought it possible later. Small face distended and thready veins standing out at the temples, and the daddy kept saying, "He was here, he was here," adrenaline ebbing, and an anger at the mummy for allowing this thing to happen, just starting to gather in wisps at his mind's extreme rear and still hours from expression. When the mummy returned, he wasn't sure whether to wrap the child in a towel or not, but he wet the towel down and did, swaddled him tight, and lifted his baby out of the sink and set him on the kitchen table's edge to soothe him, while the mummy tried to check the feet's soles with one hand, waving around in the area of her mouth and uttering objectless words, while the daddy bent in and was face to face with the child on the table's checked edge, repeating the fact that he was here and trying to calm the toddler's cries. But still, the child breathlessly screamed a high, pure, shining sound that could stop his heart, and his bitty lips and gums now tinged with the light blue of a low flame that Daddy thought, screaming as if almost still under the tilted pot in pain. A minute, two like this, that seemed much longer, with the mummy at the daddy's side talking sing-song at the child's face, and the lark on the limb with its head on to the side, and the hinge going white in a line from the weight of the canted door, until the first seen wisp of steam came lazy from under the wrapped towel's hem, and the parents' eyes met and widened. The diaper, which when they opened the towel and leaned their little boy back on the checkered cloth and unfastened the soft tabs and tried to remove it, resisted slightly with new high cries and was hot. Their baby's diaper burned their hand, and they saw where the real water had fallen and pooled and been burning their baby boy all this time while he screamed for them to help him, and they hadn't thought. And when they got it off and saw the state of what was there, the mummy said their God's first name and grabbed the table to keep her feet, while the father turned away and threw a haymaker at the air of the kitchen and cursed both himself and the world for not the last time while his child might now have been sleeping if not for the rate of his breathing and the tiny stricken motions of his hands in the air above where he lay. Hands the size of a grown man's thumb that had clutched the daddy's thumb in the crib while he'd watched the daddy's mouth move in song, his head cocked and seeming to see way past him into something his eyes made the daddy lonesome for in a sideways way. If you've never wept and want to, have a child. Break your heart inside and something will. A child is the twangy song the daddy hears again, as if the radio's lady was almost there with him, looking down at what they've done. Though hours later, what the daddy most won't forgive is how badly he wanted a cigarette right then, as they diapered the child as best they could in gauze and two crossed hand towels, and the daddy lifted him like a newborn with his skull in one palm and ran him out to the hot truck and burned custom rubber all the way to town and the clinic's ER with the tenant's door hanging open like that all day until the hinge gave. But by then it was too late. When it wouldn't stop and they couldn't make it, the child had learned to leave himself and watch the whole rest unfold from a point overhead. And whatever was lost never thenceforth mattered, and the child's body expanded and walked about and drew pay and lived its life untenanted, a thing among things, itself's soul so much vapour aloft, falling as rain and then rising, the sun up and down like a yo-yo.
Thank you. Wow. I'm not a parent, but whenever I read the story and hearing you read it as well, I read it in a state of high anxiety. And I just
which is the natural state of a parent.
But I was just wondering, knowing you are a parent, what is it like to read this story being a parent, I would imagine, of young children?
I think what's so fascinating is that David Foster Wallace wasn't a parent either. And yet there he has inhabited the world of being a parent so precisely. Part of the reason that story speaks to me so much is that most of that happened to my little brother when I was, I guess, probably 7. And he pulled a kettle off the stove. And it was a kettle that he had been allowed to play with. It was kind of a backup kettle. And he was in hospital for a long time after that. And he still got scars on his body from that. And I remember the moment, but I also remember my father afterwards and the fact that he'd given him he'd put the kettle on the stove, and he hadn't known that my mother had given my brother the kettle to play with. And it was just this agonizing moment. And I now, when my kids are playing in the kitchen, am obviously obsessive about this. But I think it's, once you decide or have thrust upon you parenthood, it is just that kind of worry all the time and knitting yourself those kinds of terrifying stories. And I guess you'd go mad if you didn't just sort of accept the risk and let it sit there. But I just think everything in that story is so real and seems to me to, so to speak, get under the skin of how it would happen and the way one would feel. And so, that's the sort of thing I guess you torture yourself with, but as a writer, that is Wallace torturing us as well. So much of his work is about this interplay of violence and boredom. This seems to me to be almost held up against the boredom. You know, the one thing you do not feel when you're reading that story is boredom.
And when you were reading it as well, your reading, certainly to begin with, was very contained. And this set up this amazing juxtaposition where you were reading this in this contained way, and yet this absolute horror was unfolding.
Mm.
And that seems also inherent in the story itself, that by through language, and I'm also thinking of the mother invoking God, almost trying to use language in some way to contain her sense of abject horror and helplessness. It's that sort of moment where it almost seems language breaks down, and it's sort of pushed aside by experience somehow.
Yeah,
and yet contained by language.
Yes, I mean it's almost inexpressible, and yet he manages to express it. And one of the other things I think is this interplay between the way that one notices the world and yet the way that that world is occluded by what is going on. So you have this the lark perched on the limb, and you have the door swinging on the hinge, and the door continues to swing until it falls off the hinge. It's you know, one thing it brings to mind is a Raymond Carver short story called A Small Good Thing, I think it is, from Cathedral, where it's a kid, Scotty, who has been hit by a car, and his parents visit him in hospital. And the way that in this story, in the Carver story, you think that the kid is going to be all right, and then he lets out this extraordinary howl and then dies. And here, the way that he ups the tension and then gives you a moment of release, of reprieve, where you think that they've got that, you know, the burns don't see them, only on the upper arm, and the tummy is okay, and then they realise, and you realise, and as the parents look at each other, you, the reader, are looking at the text thinking, oh my God, the real damage is where the water has fallen under the dike. And on a linguistic level, and in the rhythm, and it's incredibly rhythmic, you know, it's incantatory.
I mean, that's an incredibly fascinating shift there, and if we could just look at that sentence.
A minute, two like this, that seemed much longer, with the mummy at the daddy's side talking sing-song at the child's face, and the lark on the limb with its head on to the side, and the hinge going white in a line from the weight of the canted door, until the first seen wisp of steam came lazy from under the wrapped towel's hem, and the parents' eyes met and widened.
So you've got this sweep, haven't you, from sort of going in and out of the house, which he does before as well. You know, the baby, it's very sort of filmic in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. And it hones your eyes in, and I think partly what that does is it makes you think that you might have missed something, and indeed you have. So you've got this sort of almost, it's Hitchcockian, I think, there's this sense of looking around at the details and then finally focusing on the one detail that you had missed. And I think, you know, that of course is also life as a parent, is worrying somehow that you have missed the thing that ends up being the big problem, or that you have somehow not learned the rules of parenthood. And here, of course, you know, what should they have done the moment that the child was fished out of the steaming water? They should have ripped off that diaper, and you know, maybe the kid would have been okay.
It's all that sort of wisdom in retrospect, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Where the, you know, you ramify out from that point, and you get little you get little hints of what comes next, of what, you know, the daddy will beat himself up for wanting a cigarette, that that, you know, there will be an element of blame of how the mommy could have let this happen, and you think about that this is almost, I think, it is partly you are taken right there to the heart of the moment. It is partly in retrospect looking back and reconstructing those events.
And when I come back to it, and certainly this jumped out at me when you were reading, what jumped out at me was that phrase, the hinge going white in a line, and that sense that for the reader, because you were saying we go back and we sort of try and see what we may have missed, that we think perhaps for a moment, I thought that perhaps for a moment, that the worst thing that's going to happen is that the door's going to sort of snap off, and actually we realise there's much, much worse than that in store.
The diaper, which when they opened the towel and leaned their little boy back on the checkered cloth and unfastened the soft tabs and tried to remove it, resisted slightly with new high cries and was hot. Their baby's diaper burned their hand, and they saw where the real water had fallen and pooled and been burning their baby boy all this time while he screamed for them to help him, and they hadn't thought. And when they got it off and saw the state of what was there, the mummy said their God's first name and grabbed the table to keep her feet. Their God's first name, I think, is an interesting one. Again, just a line that gives you, you know, whether that is Jesus or whether that is, whether, you know, they are Jehovah's Witnesses. I don't, you know, I'm not sure what the, but it gives you this kind of, it's a small, strange phrase that takes you into a fuller world. It makes them seem more real and alive, and they do. It does that by the specificity of what is said. I think that's an interesting moment.
Do you think he's doing that as well in naming them? I mean, they're called the daddy and the mommy.
I wondered also. So at the end of the story, which I think is the real brilliance, where this child rises up and somehow you are left with uncertainty as to quite, you know, I think the first time I read it I presumed the child died, but then it's almost as if somehow the child has been made able to see its own pain objectively, and the daddy and the mommy as appellations is what the child would have called them. And so I think that somehow, in a way also here, you are seeing this story through the eyes of the child.
Because there's this phrase, isn't there, in the last part, you know, the child drew back, and then walked about, drew pale, lived its life untenanted, a thing among things, hinting, as you were saying there, that it's sort of able to see itself objectively and perhaps see the characters in this traumatic memory more objectively. I don't know what to make, I really don't know what to make of that last line.
It's self-soul so much vapour aloft, falling as rain and then rising, the sun up and down like a yo-yo. It's astonishing because I don't know. I think it, maybe one is not meant to. There is something kind of almost biblical about it, but then the yo-yo kind of brings it down to a child's toy. It's an extraordinary ending to the story, and I think is what makes it more than just a story about it's what takes it into the realms of greatness for me. Is this
the child had learned to leave himself and watch the whole rest unfold from a point overhead. And I mean, we know that people who experience deeply, deeply traumatic things, one of the results of that is dissociation, which is not good. That ability to sort of take yourself away and look at things from a very distanced from yourself point of view.
And so maybe this is about trauma, maybe this is about, you know, obviously David Foster Wallace, you know, the one other great thing he wrote, I mean, he was the kind of great poet of depression. He wrote brilliantly on depression. Depression killed him in the end, but while he was writing, he could pick apart the anatomy of depression incredibly well. And maybe this is about, you know, how this child continued to live, but continued to live in a way that didn't enable him to fully inhabit himself ever again after this moment. I also wondered whether in some way, you know, the fact that it was in his nappy, that it, you know, that it was in some way kind of, you know, he was neutered by what had
there's some
gone
sort of
on.
Gentle mutilation, yeah,
exactly.
But it's not stated at all.
It's never stated,
so
and so it leaves
imagine
it,
the worst.
Yeah, it leaves it all open to you, and therefore you have to interact with the text. You have to come to judgments on it. I mean, there's, you know, there is an ethical element to this story. Just reading, just not putting this story down, is in itself an ethical statement, because it is so painful. And yet, to me, never feels appropriative, or, you know, in that way that you sometimes read a story and you think, this is just gratuitous. This didn't strike me as gratuitous. I think that ending draws you again deeply, deeply into the story.
Yes, I mean, that moment where you do realise that the child has been scalded around its genitalia, just when you were talking about that, I realised that I probably dissociate a bit at that point, because I have not yet fully imagined, and I don't want to imagine, actually, the extent of the damage that's been done. So it's almost like when I'm reading it, it's almost like I see the nappy come off and it kind of goes pixelated or something.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
I don't
and
want
that's
to.
Do you know what, that's a really interesting exercise when you're reading this story, and it probably spoils it me even talking about it, but I don't know how I could do it without flagging that up. But if you try and kind of monitor how much you allow yourself to see in your kind of internal cinema, and you find that you sort of shut out stuff. I think that's absolutely right. And that's what I was thinking exactly. How much do you picture here compared with how much you picture in when you're reading, you know, George Eliot? And I think they are different. One of the things, you know, this is, again, it's that picking at a scab that parenthood entails. And when I wrote this Bleeding City, you know, the story opens with a guy who realizes he's left his kid in the car, that it's a boiling hot day outside. He'd been taking his child to creche. He had to stop by the office to pick up some papers, and he got called into a meeting, and this happened. And that was written before, it was actually written during, that whole novel was written during my wife's first pregnancy, so it was before I knew what it was to be a parent, but imagining myself into that world of kind of constant anxiety. And it has been pretty much like that. I think, you know, one of the tortures of being a writer is that you do drag yourself into these things.
I mean, another thing, of course, that is quite common with depression is this terrible inner critic. The self-blaming, self-judging is at a maniacal level. And that comes in the story as well, doesn't it? Where the thing that the father, right at the end, he can't forgive himself for, is just how badly he wanted a cigarette right then as they diapered. I mean, that feels very...
And of course, this was one of Wallace's great obsessions, was that if we were able to concentrate properly, then we would not be depressed. We would not, and of course, the we there is he, I think. Whatever we may do, most of us either know children, or we have had children, or we might one day have children. But
Or
we were children. But we can inhabit that place, you know. And we were siblings as well. You know, that keeps coming back to me how important that was for this story, for me, just to have had that moment. And I'm sure, and everyone has those kind of childhood, you know, mad rushes to the A&E and
were you there for that?
I was there, yeah.
Did you actually witness this?
I was standing probably 4 meters away from him.
How do you feel you've processed what was obviously a very traumatic memory for you as well, as a bystander?
Yeah, I mean, not as traumatic as for him or I think, but yeah, it's one of those bright, horrible moments from one's childhood that kind of are the beads on the thread, all the thread being the stuff you can't remember, and then the beads being those flashes of either wonderful moments or terrible moments that you can remember, and that is one of those terrible moments that really illuminates my memories of my childhood. Hands the size of a grown man's thumb that had clutched the daddy's thumb in the crib while he'd watched the daddy's mouth move in song, his head cocked and seeming to see way past him into something his eyes made the daddy lonesome for in a sideways way. If you've never wept and want to have a child,